All right, so I'm delighted to welcome back to Perimeter Liang Dai as our speaker today. So Liang is, I think, you know, well known to many of us here, but if you don't know him, so he's currently a professor of physics at UC Berkeley. He just started there after finishing his Bacall Fellowship at the IIS in Princeton. So Liang works on many topics related to astrophysics and cosmology. But he has a special interest, you know, it seems, in both gravitational lensing and also in gravitational waves. And so therefore, it's very fitting then that his talk today will combine those two topics. So his seminar will be on his Schrödinger lens gravitational waves from LIGO Virgo. And so Liang, whenever you're ready, just take it away.
Thanks for the introduction. And I visited Perimeter several times in the past, so today I could not visit in person. Hopefully I could do that in the near future. So today I would like to talk about gravitational lensing of gravitational waves, and in particular I would like to present our recent work done with a number of collaborators previously at the IIS. So we performed a search for possible lensed signals in the open LIGO Virgo data. So then for this talk, I think I would like to talk about the following things. So first, I would like to give a quick introduction of gravitational lensing phenomenon, and then I will talk about what we have understood about this phenomena theoretically. What do we expect to see? And then I will very quickly summarize what were the previous search efforts presented in the literature before I start to present our own analysis. So basically, gravitational lensing is a very generic phenomenon reflecting the fact that when you have any waves propagating in non-homogeneous backgrounds, then you can have distortions to the wavefront. So here I just have a cartoon where I put a wave source here, and then it emits spherical waves. If the surrounding space-time is uniform, then the wavefront will be perfect spheres. But then in general relativity, if you have some massive object, it curves nearby space-time. So then effectively the wave is propagating in a non-uniform background, and that causes deformations of the waveform. So by the time you have a distant observer here, oh, by the way, can you guys see my cursor?
Yes, yeah, definitely.
That's good, yeah. So by the time a distant observer observes the wavefront here, you might measure very dramatic distortion of the wavefront reflected in the intensity and the phase of the waves. So for this talk, I will focus on the so-called strong lensing regime, which is when this distortion is very dramatic. It's not some tiny correction. So then essentially gravitational lensing is expected whenever you have very distant sources in the universe. The reason is that the cross-section for strong lensing to happen can be quantified using this so-called critical surface density, this parameter. So this is related to the gravitational constant and also some characteristic distance to the source or the lens. So if we put this distance to be the cosmological distance, we get this number, 10 to the 8 solar masses per square kiloparsec. And this number suggests that in the universe, almost everywhere it's pretty empty, but then only near the very center of dark matter halos, there is a concentration of baryonic matter. That is where the galaxies form. And then at the center of this halo where the galaxy is, the surface density can reach this number. So this means that only the central galaxy sitting inside a big dark matter halo can produce strong lensing typically. So if all the matter in the universe is distributed in infinitely compact objects, then we know that once we go to cosmological distances, then the strong lensing cross-section approaches order unity. In the real universe, this supercritical condition only happens at the tip of this island. So basically, roughly speaking, you have this 10 to the 8 solar masses within a 10 to the 12 solar mass halos. So then you do this correction, you get a strong lensing estimate for the strong lensing probability at the cosmological distances to be something like 10 to the minus 4. So this is a small number, but once you have, this is a small number, but once you have a lot of sources, it's not negligible. So since the discovery of LIGO Virgo of gravitational wave sources, we realized that the most abundant gravitational wave sources at large distances are binary black hole mergers, especially the very massive ones. So here I just show a catalog from the LIGO's first and second science runs. And you can see that already many of the BBH events, they come from very large distances, almost cosmological. Their redshift is approaching order unity. And this is even more the case during the O3 run, which just finished. So this means that just like distant galaxies, quasars, and supernova, these optical sources, binary black hole mergers as gravitational wave sources should also be subject to strong lensing. So in order to understand, you know, in a general way, how lensing happens, we can, it is easy to it is easy to describe it in the following way. So as long as the departure from flat space time is a small perturbation, then we can, the phenomenon is a linear phenomenon. So basically by that, what I mean is we can take any observed waveform, which is a sequence in the time domain, and then we can do a Fourier transform to get the frequency components. Then the lensed waveform can be written as the unlensed waveform multiplied by some factor, f as a function of frequency. This f factor is a complex number. So it encodes both changes to the wave amplitude and also changes to the phase. So most generally, if we have a lens living on a single lens plane, then we can formally write this f of omega, this number, through the diffraction integral. So this can be understood as summing over all possible paths, but then each path carries a phase. So this phase is e to the I omega tau, where tau is the so-called Fermat potential, which is essentially the travel time of the wave as a function of ray. So we distinguish two regimes. One is the more general wave diffraction regime, where the wavelength is comparable to the Schwarzschild scale of the lens, so GM over C squared. So in this case, we have to do some general numerical calculation to get this factor. But then there's also this so-called geometrical regime where the wavelength is much smaller than the Schwarzschild scale. So in this regime, there's a simplification because the integral will be dominated by the so-called stationary point of the Fermat potential. And then in that case, we get some contribution from each stationary point, and each contribution is in the following form. There's It's proportional to the square root of the usual flux magnification factor, and then there's a phase factor encoding some time delay associated with that stationary point. And then there's also a very tricky Morse phase. So this I will go into more details later. So here on the right, it's just a sketch showing a typical situation where the Fermat potential can have multiple stationary points, and these stationary points can be classified into different types depending on whether or not they are the minimal point, the saddle points, or the maximal point of the Fermat potential. So in the geometrical regime, the description of lensing is actually very simple. We will observe waves associated with different stationary points, and these waves, they differ by their overall amplitude constant and also by a time delay. But apart from that, the frequency chirping is identical. So lensing does not change the frequency of the wave. So because of that, if we only observe a single wave packet associated with a single stationary point, then it's actually impossible for us to figure out that this is a lensed waveform, especially for, and this is strictly true for a binary black hole merger signal, because BBH signal doesn't have a special scale encoded in it. So this means that what we can measure from the waveform is the combination of mass and 1 plus z, the redshifted mass. And then we can separately measure the combination of luminosity distance and the square root of the magnification factor mu. So this means that if we don't know a priori that there's a mu that is not equal to 1, then our inference for the intrinsic masses and the redshifts are biased. So here on the left, I show some a numerical representation of this effect. So here on the horizontal axis is the true value, is the true redshift of a BBH source, and vertical axis is the inferred redshift. And then the red contours have constant magnification factors, and the blue dashed ones have constant biased factors. So the inferred mass m prime over the true mass m. What you can see is that if we only detect the sources with pretty low apparent redshift, we are living in this corner, then this is a small effect. You need extremely large magnification factors to have significant bias. But once we start to observe events coming from cosmological redshifts or the unity, then we no longer need a very dramatic magnification factors. We can have more reasonable magnification factor that causes a significant bias. So in short words, magnified signals will appear heavier and closer to us than they actually are. And the opposite situation is true. If we have demagnified signals, then black holes appear lighter and further away from us than they actually are. So the above discussion neglects this Morse phase, which is a topological effect. It turns out that this topological effect is also very interesting. So this effect is in the form of an additional phase, which is equal to integer multiples of pi over 2. And this integer is equal to the number of negative eigenvalues for the lensing deformation matrix associated with each stationary point. So it is equal to 0 for minimal point, 1 for saddle points, and 2 for maximal points. But also note that this is not just a trivial constant phase multiplying everything, because you have to add this sign of the frequency. So it does change the, in general, it does change the shape of the wave packet. So restricted.
Oh, wait, sorry. I didn't follow that. So omega just means
the frequency.
Yeah, right. So it's like the frequency that we observe. So what does the sine of omega mean?
It means that because when we because the waveform is a real sequence, right, in the time domain. So when you do Fourier transform, you get positive frequency components and negative frequency components, and the coefficient have to be complex conjugate of each other because of the reality condition. So that means, you know, we have to put this sine of omega here. If we don't put it here, it's mathematically incorrect, right? It doesn't satisfy the reality condition. So that is why this has
okay,
to...
Okay, I see. Okay, right. You're just enforcing that the, you know, that the waveform as a function of time is real. I see.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So this is actually very defective because usually people only talk about positive frequencies, so they don't put this factor explicitly. Mm-hmm. Then it gives you the false impression that, you know, this is just a boring constant multiplying everything.
Can I also ask why it's pi over 2 and not pi? Yeah.
I think this comes from when you do this one-dimensional Gaussian integral. So you do integral over x e to the I x squared over 2. Then you pick up I. So this I is e to the I pi over 2. This is, I don't know if this is a good answer because perhaps you're asking more about what's the physical meaning, right?
I guess kind of, right. I mean, well, right. So I'm just used to, you know, like the parity flipping, for like saddle points compared to minima. And so flipping the parity, I guess I would have just thought as like multiplying f by like minus one. But instead it's multiplying f by...
Yeah, it's not just a minus sign. If it's a minus sign, then it's less interesting. So because it's a complex number, you actually change the shape of the waveform.
Okay, yeah, interesting.
So this formula is general. It doesn't matter what kind of wave you have. But then if we restrict to the special case of binary black hole merger signals, then it turns out that this effect is degenerate. Let me just be more precise. If we assume that
So this Morse phase seems to be interesting. So is this, do you assume some like, I don't know, the lens is weak or something like that. So if I look at, let's say, if I have a point source behind a black hole, and this point source send out a pulse, and this pulse can just directly go to us, or it can go around the black hole multiple times and come to us. So as a result, we will see a sequence of poles.
Yes.
So this sequence of poles actually follow similar behavior as you are.
I think so, because because we know, for example, in the weak field regime that you only care about two such images. So the secondary image is a saddle point image. But then in the strong gravity regime, you will just have an infinite sequence of images, right?
Yeah, so each one is like multiplier in your language.
I'm not sure if each one is successively multiplied by e to the I pi over 2, but I think they will have
it is, when people look at the Green function, it is like that. So it's like a fourfold symmetry. People in that context always talk about that.
Yes.
So I guess this is true not only for this kind of weak. So plane and lens or something like that.
And also I want to emphasize that this effect survives even in the short wavelength limit, right? So in that sense, you can say this is some kind of remaining effect of the wave mechanical nature. So, you know, everything else is this can be described as rays, you know, shooting rays and do geometry, but then this effect cannot be explained within that framework. You have to go to the full wave mechanical behavior. So
I have a question. So this is in frequency space, but if you were to describe this in real, in terms of a strain, so what does this do to the strain?
It depends on the shape of the real space wave packet. But if I give you an example, I don't know if I can draw on the. I think I can draw something on the screen.
There is a white. There is an option for.
I think the simplest case is that if say the wave in the time domain, the wave packet. For some reason, it doesn't work. Okay, I'll just say by words. So imagine you have a wave packet in whose shape is takes the form of a Gaussian function. So then it goes up and goes down, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then if you apply a saddle point, the Morse phase of the saddle point, then it actually becomes a parity odd shape. You go up, and then you go down to the negative, and then you go back to zero.
Right.
So it changes. But then on the other hand, if you consider a monochromatic wave, single frequency, perfect sine, then this extra I is boring because it just shifts the wave by 1/4 of a cycle. So it doesn't change the shape. So basically this effect changes the shape if you have a distribution of frequencies.
Mm-hmm. So a Gaussian is turned to something that's parity odd, you said?
So Gaussian, you go up and you go down, right? It's symmetric.
Yeah.
If you apply I, you go up or you go down to negative and then you go back to zero. Mm-hmm. So you have, yeah. So I think in signal processing, this transformation is called the Hilbert transformation.
Mm, okay, thanks.
So let's go back to the BBH signal. If we restrict to the most common situation where the orbit is circular and also the dominant contribution is the 2-2 harmonic, then actually the Morse phase effect is degenerate with a discrete change in the orbital phase. So basically you just divide by a factor of 2 because for every one orbit you have 2 wave cycles for the 2-2 mode. So this is interesting to know. This means that even though there is this effect, if you just fit using the standard 2-2 template, you will still get a good fit, but you just get the wrong orbital phase. Okay. All right. So let me talk about the rate of these events. So what do we expect? How often this kind of strong lensing effect can happen? There has been a lot of work done in the literature. So typically the theoretical calculation has 2 ingredients. One is that you need to have a model for the population of lenses.
I was going to ask something about the previous slide again, sorry. Right. So if I was looking at an electromagnetic source rather than a source of gravitational waves, would anything change?
I think the same thing will happen. So this formula is true for any wave as long as this polarization degree, you know, decouples from this wave equation, right? It's something multiplying everything, so the two polarizations don't talk to each other.
So how then do I then get like the normal geometric optics, you know, like result, you know, that for negative parity images, you know, the image flips as opposed to...
No, the image doesn't flip because this is really the phase. So in usual optical experiment, you never get to measure the phase, right? You always measure the intensity. Of course, you can measure the phase by doing by interfering two waves, but that's a different story. So yeah, so I think it happens also for light. It's just that this is an effect that usually we don't perceive. It's not something that we can very easily see by eye. You have to measure the phase of the wave.
Right, you know, but we do see lens like radio sources that we observe using interferometers.
In that case, I think the same effect is happening. And perhaps people can measure this. But I think what is very special about gravitational waves is that you have a very precise theoretical model for the waveform, including the phase information before any lensing effect operates. Mm-hmm. So basically, you know, without lensing, what you expect. And that helps you a lot at figuring out that there is this phase shift. When you observe radio waves, of course, this effect is still there, but you don't know a priori what is the intrinsic waveform, right? It's usually just some random thing. So that's why it's not very easy to measure. But I think it's still possible to measure through some kind of cross-correlation test.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, right. So if we had some sort of like coherent source, like a FRB or something, you're saying that we would be able to tell if it's been strongly lensed because like the phase of one of the components will be pi over 2 out of... Yeah, this just seems very surprising to me.
Let's say you see two FRBs. What you can do is you perform Hilbert transform to one, to the voltage a series of one FRB, and then you correlate with the other FRB, you find that there's actually a super significant correlation, right? But then if you turn off this Morse phase, you find that the correlation disappears. Then you know that probably this is because of saddle point image.
Okay, interesting. All right, thanks.
Right, so, okay, slightly different topic. What's the rate of this BBN lensing, right? The two theoretical agreement, one is that you need to have a model for the population of lenses. So in our universe, these will be the giant galaxies are the dominant lenses. You need to compute what's the abundance as a function of distance. And the second thing is you need to have a population model for the sources, which is highly uncertain at this point, especially if we go to redshifts that are beyond the current detection limit. But still, you know, if you, depending on what is the origin of these mergers, if you say they are coming from field binary evolution, then you have some theoretical model for it. This is what people do. And then note that even though the a priori lensing probability is low, you have the magnification bias effect because you can see some events beyond your normal horizon because of magnification. So the observed fraction of strongly lensed event will be boosted. So typically, there's a range of answers in the literature, but I would say the uncertainty is something like one out of magnitude for at least for the standard BBH formation from just from the usual stars. So the this would be some small number, 0.01 per year for 01, 02, but then for fully upgraded LIGO Virgo, it could reach one per year. And then on the right, I show some mock catalog of lensed events. The point is to made by Auguri, and the point is to show that what are the typical magnification factor and the typical time delay, right? If you find a pair of images, and then you can see that at least for second generation detectors. There's a very wide range of time delays. You have both extremely short time delays and very long time delays. And for the very short time delays, they necessarily have very high magnification factors because this is basically a configuration near the caustic. I also want to point out that here, you know, the catalog cuts off because there's no group or cluster scale lenses included in the mock catalog. So if you include them, you expect that actually the time delay will extend further to the to here, you know, hundreds of days, months to years. And in fact, we do see these kind of events in quasar lensing. Yeah, so this is another slide trying to emphasize that the contribution of group and cluster lenses may be not dominant, but still not negligible. You have to account for those. And especially if you consider lens redshift that is low, because the abundance of clusters increases very rapidly, right, toward redshift zero. So here people do a, people extract lenses from cosmological simulation with the galaxy formations. And then they have to combine two different simulations to include both cluster scale lenses and galaxy lenses. So they find that especially for the highly magnified events, the contribution of group scale and cluster scale lenses is significant. It's still not dominating, but something you cannot simply neglect. Theoretically, people often neglect them because these lenses can have very complicated substructure, so it's kind of difficult to calculate analytically. So what do we can learn from these lensed events, right? There are a couple of interesting applications. I'll just briefly mention them. One is that, of course, you will detect sources beyond the usual detection horizon. So for a given experiment, this is very powerful. The second thing is, since we don't expect a detectable, easily detectable electromagnetic counterpart to BBH event, it's actually very difficult to localize them to a host galaxy. So if we can detect a galaxy strong lensing BBHs, and then we localize the lens and the host galaxy in using electromagnetic observations, then maybe we can figure out what are the typical host galaxies, and we can even localize the source to some part within the host galaxy. And then by observing these lensed events, we can have a very different view of the structure of the lens, the profile of the lens, especially the central structure where demagnified central images can exist. And also note that by observing gravitational waves, we are not subject to the usual strong selection effects that complicates electromagnetic observations. And finally, if you do have galaxy lensing, the substructure living inside the galaxies might play a role. And many of these substructures might be completely non-luminous. They don't host stars. But however, because gravitational waves can have a long wavelength, so we might have interesting wave diffraction effects that reveal the presence of this substructure. So I think this by itself is an interesting topic, even though I will not discuss too much today. So previously people restricted in the geometrical limit and tried to look for multiple avatar signals coming from the same source. So the simplest thing one can do, as Hanuk Sella et al. Did, is that they take the catalog of LIGO BBH detections and then they try to quantify if any pair among this catalog, they happen to have the same parameters. So to quantify that, they define the following Bayes evidence ratio. So they test the hypothesis that the two events share the same masses, spins, sky coordinates, and other parameters versus they have independent parameters. And another thing they test is they test if the time delay is just what you expect from random pair or if it's more consistent with what you expect from lensing, which will show a log, roughly speaking, log flat behavior. So what they find is that even though there's an interesting pair in terms of parameter coincidence, it's very significant, this August 14 event and the January 4th event. But the time delay, because the time delay is long, it is disfavored in this dimension. So eventually they conclude that even their best pair is not statistically significant enough in this Bayes evidence ratio analysis. So based on this work, this other work done by McIsaac et al., they look for possible additional images that are hidden below the detection threshold. So this is basically you take a single template as informed from the pair you're interested in, and then you do a search. In this way, you reduce the look elsewhere effect, and then you can push down the detection limit a bit further. So in their analysis, they do find a couple of interesting candidates, but again, because of the time delay is very long, they judge that they are not significant enough. But here, I just want to show that they also confirm that in terms of just the parameter coincidence, this August event and the January event is quite anomalous. So at the IS, because we also did some theoretical work on lensing of gravitational waves, we got interested in this. And because we have our independent search pipeline to analyze signals, we want to do an independent analysis. So first, we argue that there could be something one might worry about this Bayesian evidence ratio approach, because first of all, this Bayesian evidence ratio can be sensitive to the prior of the intrinsic parameters for these BBHs, which we don't know yet. The second thing is that even the sky coordinates can play tricks, because the gravitational wave detector is highly anisotropic. The sensitivity is highly anisotropic. So as the detector pattern rotates on the sidereal sky, certain latitudes can have more sensitivity than others. So this you might want to take into account. And finally, if we calculate this Bayes evidence ratio in brute force, it is a calculation in very high dimension. So typically, what people do is they use kernel density estimation so that they can use posterior examples to do this calculation. But one might worry that in very high dimensional space, this approach might not be reliable. Especially if the posterior shows some very funny shape in higher dimensions. One has to tune this kernel density estimation parameters to make sure that the answer is correct. So to mitigate these problems, our strategy would be to do something as simple as possible. And also, we want to separately consider the coincidence in intrinsic parameters, namely the masses and the spins, versus extrinsic parameters, namely the sky coordinates, distance, inclination, and so on. And by quantifying them separately, we reduce the number of dimensions and therefore mitigate possible numerical difficulties. So the first thing we test is the agreement in intrinsic parameters. We do, instead of parametrizing waveform in terms of physical masses and spins, we instead consider geometric coordinates in the space of gravitational wave facing. So these are the coordinates we used in our previous work to construct templates. So the good thing about these coordinates is that the likelihood in terms of them takes the simple Gaussian form. So it will not show some funny behavior. And then again, we define similar Bayes evidence ratio, which is shown here. But then we take a hybrid approach. So we combine base evidence ratio versus a frequentist approach. That is, we do this for the event, for the pair. We also do this for injected events following some prior. And then we plot the distribution for the score for these injected events and then see how consistent the measured score is with the distribution. So we find that the measured value seems to be anomalous at the percent level. And then we do a similar test for the extrinsic parameter. So in this case, we consider the sky coordinates, inclination, polarization angle, and orbital phase. But then orbital phase, we account for this discrete Morse phase shift, which can differ between the two events. As for the time and distance, because we don't know what is the lensing time delay and what is the magnification factor ratio, we exclude them from this analysis. So then what we do is we compute some sort of marginalized likelihood, marginalized over all of these extrinsic parameters. And we again compute the ratio between the two hypotheses. And following the other works, we also define this evidence ratio for the time delay. So the random time versus the log flat time delay distribution. So what we found here is that extrinsic parameters, we have false alarm probability is sub percent, but then the time delay, because it's long, so it's not favored by the lensing hypothesis. If we combine both, we again get some number that is less than 1% separately for the extrinsic parameters. And then what we do further is that assuming lensing is true, we can try to look for additional lensed images. What we did is that we take these two LIGO-Virgo significant detections, we find the best fit waveform, and we use it as a single template. And then when we look for triggers, we also force the position on the sky to be consistent with these other two events. So by doing this, we achieved an overall 10 to the 4 reduction in the Lockhaus wave effect, which makes us 20% more sensitive in the string amplitude. So somewhat surprisingly, we actually find a sub-threshold signal, which we call GWC170620, with a false alarm probability only at the 1% level, determined empirically using the time slides. So this is surprising. This means that unexpectedly we have a third event. So this is partially confirmed in this very recent work by these three authors. They did a calculation similar to Hanaxella et al, but the only difference is that because they want to check if this kernel density estimation is reliable, they recompute the numerator of that base evidence ratio by doing joint parameter estimation. So they explore the joint parameter space for the two events under the lensing hypothesis, and in that way they can calculate the Bayesian evidence. So again, they find that, they include the LIGO catalog, but then they have to manually add this new event because they don't search for they didn't search for it separately. But then they find that the most significant pairs in terms of the intrinsic parameter coincidence, in terms of just the intrinsic plus extrinsic, but excluding time delay. This coincidence, the most significant three pairs are basically these three events that we reported. And also they confirmed that there is a viable Morse phase value that is consistent with geometrical lensing. But of course, the time delay between these three events are pretty long, so they are again disfavored in this dimension. So this is well known. So I think apart from just the parameter coincidence, we think these three events are interesting because they are also, they show consistent Morse phase signatures with geometrical lensing. So what the test we did is different from the previous slide. We don't by hand force a valid Morse phase value. Instead, we want the data to tell us what is the value, what is the value in the data, basically. So the way we do it is when we do joint parameter estimation, we force all the parameters to be the same between the two events, except that this orbital phase, we allow independent values for the two events. So previously, people argued that this Morse phase is not detectable because the orbital phase is always poorly measured due to parameter degeneracy. This is in fact not true because we can still measure the relative Morse phases pretty accurately. The reason is, despite the parameter degeneracy, we can accurately measure the phase observed in each of the detectors. And the difference in these phases, since now you fix all the other parameters, will be attributed to the difference in the orbital phases. So this means that even though for individual event, we cannot well determine the orbital phase, we can very well determine the difference between the orbital phases for the two events. So here I just show the result. We did this exercise for each of the two pairs. And here the red crosses just show locations on this plane that are consistent with geometrical lensing. And then we just find that the result is consistent with one of the values and is clearly not consistent with any of the other values. And we estimate that there's a 1 in 6 chance that this just happens randomly. So this adds just adds additional evidence supporting the lensing hypothesis.
Wait, Leon. Does the ordering make sense here? So you're seeing like a pi difference between the earliest and the latest.
You are onto the tricky point, which is I'm going to discuss later.
Okay.
Yeah. You're thinking very fast, right? So you see the problem.
But one more actually question. So have you mentioned also, you know, like the inferred distances to these sources? So are the distances consistent with being?
I'm going to say it in the next slide.
Okay, great. Thanks.
So through this joint analysis, we can also measure the magnification ratios. We cannot measure the absolute magnification because there's always a degeneracy between magnification and distance, right? But we can measure the magnification ratios. So just to give you some rough idea, the network SNRs for these three events are 18, 14, 7.8 respectively. So that translates into a flux magnification ratio that is surprisingly high. It is actually 1 versus 1/6 versus 1/15. So if lensing is true, this means that we can actually detect very bright images and very faint images simultaneously. This is actually quite difficult in optical observation, right? The reason is that we are measuring with gravitational waves, we are measuring the strain amplitude. So this allows us to have a larger dynamic ratio, dynamic range in flux. So here in this plot, I just summarized what we found. So basically, for these two LIGO events, the false alarm rate, excluding intrinsic parameters, just consider extrinsic parameters, is at the percent level. And then the existence of a third event adds another 1% false alarm probability. The time delays are very long. This seems to be inconsistent with the very small lenses. The most phase differences we measure is 0, pi, and pi. So this means that there are no saddle points, a point I'm going to discuss more in the next slide. Magnification ratios are pretty high. The apparent luminosity distance, of course, because we don't know the absolute distance, so we express the whole thing in this form, the distance to the loudest event divided by the magnification factor for that event is actually not so far, is 600 megaparsec. But again, a priori, we don't expect that we should see even one such lens event in O2, based on our current understanding of the population models and the population of the lenses. Another thing is, if one of the events, say the August event, has very high magnification factors, then it's a near caustic configuration. There could be a counterpart image that is very close to it in time. We realized that just about 4 to 5 hours after this August event, there is a special window when the two LIGO detectors become almost blind toward that direction on the sky. So, in fact, the Virgo at that time became the most sensitive detector. So we also did a search for any possible strong signal hiding here because of the poor sensitivity. And to our surprise, we find that if there's an image equally loud as GW170814, it can well hide in the Gaussian noise. So we actually find a trigger, but that trigger, the score is not high enough that we can say this is not Gaussian random noise. But still, it's interesting to know that this detector sensitivity can play such a big role, that you can hide a very loud event just because it's coming at the wrong time. The biggest problem we have with the lensing interpretation is not necessarily the long time delays and a priori small probability, right? Because these may be subject to theoretical uncertainty. The biggest problem, as Neil started to realize already, is that the image types do not seem to make a lot of sense to us. So let us use the notation following Blandford and Narayan, this seminal paper. So the three types of images let us denote these minimal images as L, saddle points as S, and maximal points as H. So just from the relative Morse phase measurement, we can say that there are no saddle point images among these three. So it's either LHH in time order or HLL. Of course, S images, there have to be some because of this relation, general relation, but maybe we just miss them because there's a significant fraction of the time when there was at least one LIGO detector not operating. So this is by itself is not surprising. But further, because we have the general theorem that L images have to have magnification larger than one, this means that for either scenario, there's always an H image that is significantly magnified. So this is very surprising because usually these H images form near the center, near the density peak of the lens, the center of the galaxy or the cluster. And there, because the surface density changes very rapidly with the radius, these H images are typically highly demagnified. They are very difficult to find in optical observations. So here, the only way that you can make very bright H image seems to be this radial arc configuration, where you tune the source position to one of the inner caustic, and then you get a magnified H image. But then you also get a magnified saddle point image, which has a very, which should have a very small time delay with the H image. They're very close together. So from the fact that we don't, if there's a saddle point image within 1 hour of the August event, we can safely rule it out. So from that, we can put a lower bound on the on the source redshift for either of the two scenarios. We can also put, I correct myself. So the fact that there's no counter image within 1 hour leads to a upper bound. The lower bound for either of the scenarios just come from the fact that this H image is magnified. Yeah, so this is really surprising. This is just not very consistent with what we think the image configuration typically should look like, given that we have these galaxy lenses in the universe. Of course, because we do joint parameter estimation, we can also improve on the sky coordinate constraint. So here, if we combine all three events, we actually achieve only 16 square degrees uncertainty on the sky. And this is a very, this is very impressive. If you only do this for a single event, even with three detectors, you get a sky localization arrow ellipse that is much larger than 16 square degrees. However, the universe is still very big. So even within this 16 square degrees, you just have many, many galaxies. The time delay events, the time delays for these events are pretty long on the order of months, which suggest galaxy group or galaxy cluster scale lenses. So this can narrow down on the number of possible lenses, assuming this is true. But still, because we don't have existing good spectroscopic data, so it seems that currently we cannot easily find a lens. Okay, so I think to summarize, this triplet remains inconclusive. On the one hand, it is anomalous because even excluding intrinsic parameters, say, you know, we don't really know what is the intrinsic distribution of masses and spins, so maybe all of the BBHs look very similar to each other. Regardless of that, just the extrinsic parameter coincidence between the two events is at the percent level. And then the third signal is also very unlikely to just arise randomly. So this seems to suggest that this triplet is very curious. But then as a theorist, we really worry about the information we infer from the Mohr's phase measurements, the small apparent source distance, and the long time delays. So it's not mathematically impossible to produce a lensed event like this. It's just that this is not the most common thing that we think should happen in our universe. So basically, the level of tuning in the lens model seems to countervail the low false alarm probability. Since the source is unlikely to be too far, if indeed this is a lensed event, and if the BBH host is not a tiny galaxy, then an optical follow-up might be easier to find the host galaxy than the average case. So this means that maybe, you know, we can at least rule out, if we do a thorough follow-up, we might rule out the possibility that this is lensed. Finally, I would say that if this is not lensing, we really don't have any better explanation, you know, why we have this coincidence other than just some statistical fluke. So despite the inconclusion, I think there's still a lot of interesting lessons learned from this exercise. So the first, I think the most important thing is relative Mohr's phases are measurable. They can be measured to decent accuracy. So as we demonstrate with this example, these Morse faces provide a lot of interesting information, further constraining the viable lenses. So they are going to, we expect that in future analysis, the Morse face test will be very powerful at constraining any viable lens. The other thing is because the sensitivity antenna pattern just rotates with the Earth, even very loud lens, the images can hide in noise. So don't be too surprised that some loud images are missed. Conversely, some very faint lens images can just happen to be detectable. Finally, if this triplet is a pure statistical fluke, it might suggest that we are already limited by the false alarms. So I think to further improve in the future, one of the followings should happen. So either we detected a pair of events whose time delay is very short, on the order of days or even hours. So in this case, lensing hypothesis will be much more favored than just random coincidence. And the second thing is that if in the future three detector localization is common, then it is much more difficult to just by chance have the same sky localization. So this will give us much more discriminative power. If in the future the low frequency end of the sensitivity is improved, then we will get a lot more official information in the parameter estimation so that the error bars on the intrinsic parameters and extrinsic parameters will shrink substantially. So in that case, any coincidence will be much more significant. And finally, for upgraded detectors, we might be able to detect even the lower mass BBH events, so those with masses less than 10 solar masses to cosmological distances. For those events, the mass measurement is very accurate. We have many significant digits. So if we find two events that have identical parameters, that would be very anomalous. So I think even though currently we haven't uncovered lensed events, both theoretical argument and observational prospect suggest that we should be able to find them with the upgraded LIGO detectors. Okay, I think I will finish just here.
Okay, great. So let's thank Leon for his great talk. So everyone can feel free to unmute themselves.
Yeah, thanks for
that. Okay, great. So any further questions for the speaker?
I'm still a little bit confused about this Morse face measurement. So how do you measure this relative phase? I mean, these two, let's say they're two, they're the lensing pair, they're separated by months or so. So you have to be able to keep track of the phase along this months long time separation, although you have, I don't know, measurement yes. Plenty of all the binary black hole parameters, right? You cannot measure the frequency or the mass of the binary so precisely. Yeah.
What we were really measuring is, because I argue that the Morse phase changes is degenerate with the orbital phase changes, right? So what we are really measuring is the orbital phases for both events. And here, let me just explain this part more clearly. So here, the observed strain in the detector H is equal to the linear combination of the two polarizations. And then the coefficient for each polarization depends on the sky position, alpha, delta, and the so-called polarization angle, psi. So of course, the phase of the H plus and H cross in the source frame depends on also the orbital phase. as I shown here, the orbital phase and the inclination iota. So this means that if you fix all of these parameters, then you can predict what is the phase you should see in the detector. Now, when we analyze the two LIGO events, right, we can measure the observed phase very well directly from data. So now the question is, can we convert that back to the orbital phase? For a single event, we really can't, because the orbital phase is degenerate with many other parameters. So we can only measure very well a certain combination of all of these parameters. But when we test the lensing hypothesis, we have to set the same value for all the other parameters except for the orbital phase. So in this case, any difference in the observed phase between the two images after you account for the the time of the event, the position of the event, which is encoded in this F plus and F cross coefficients, right? Any residual difference must be due to the difference in phi. So in this way, we can measure delta phi, even though we cannot measure phi in the absolute phi. I don't know if I have explain this clearly or not.
Right. So are you saying that this separation between these two images, right, this Mellenstein separation does not give you actual difficulty in this?
It doesn't give us difficulty. The reason is we know exactly the time of the event. We know exactly at that time what is the orientation of the detectors. We know exactly where the signal comes from on the sky. Right, because that of course we don't know exactly, but we have a good constraint because we have two events, right? So these two events, they overlap on the sky somewhere, and that has to be the position of the source. I think the short answer is that all of these they are just some complicated details, but it doesn't pose difficulty because we exactly know those parameters.
Okay. So another question is, when you estimate this statistical significance, did you add in this prior that you're talking about, the prior that you, the strong lensing prior, it's 10 to the minus 4?
No, we didn't add this prior. In fact, in this paper, they add, so for this number, BLU, which quantifies just the parameter coincidence except for the time delay, they add a prior, but their prior is a inclusive one in the sense that they add a probability that you have any lensed event. So which means that you don't need to produce a lensed event that has the characteristic of this event, meaning that you have long time delays, you have this weird Morse phase difference. So you just add an inclusive probability. So yeah, they include it, and they find that even after they include it, it is still significant. In our case, we didn't add this prior. Because on the other hand, it's really difficult to add this prior. This number can, depending on what is your assumption, this number can change a lot. Yeah, so we just argue without exact numbers. We say that because the false alarm rate, if you combine everything, it's at most 10 to minus 4. And it seems that this is not low enough for us to completely dismiss the theoretical prior. Especially the time delay is long and the Morse phase is peculiar.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Leon. For the triple events, the flux magnification ratio can be as small as 1 in 15, but the SNR is only different by a factor at most 2. So is it also explained by the antenna pattern?
Yes. So okay. From here, you can really see that this antenna pattern play a lot of tricks, right?
Mm-hmm.
At a given time, if you are coming from the good spot, the detector can be a factor of 2 or even 3 more sensitive than if you're coming from a blind spot. So a factor of 2 or 3 in string amplitude is a factor of 10 in flux. So that's a big factor.
Okay.
Any further questions?
So I have a question. What are the kind of physical structure about physical assumptions about the substructure in the dark matter halo that goes into this time delay prior?
I think I guess you're referring to this catalog, right?
Yeah, that's right.
All of these events, they are produced by galaxy scale lenses, meaning that these halos are very big. These halos are at least 10 to the 12 solar masses and is hosting a major galaxy. So I guess for that part, we have, the theoretical model for the abundance is empirically calibrated. We have observations. We know, how many galaxies are there in the universe of this size. So I think that this part is not so sensitive to the uncertainty in the small lenses, meaning that, maybe these halos hosting dwarf galaxy or completely dark halos. So those are much smaller.
Yeah, but they could add to the magnification and the thing with the small time delay, we don't see those.
Right. I guess you're saying on this end, right, on the very short time delay, very high magnification, then this may be sensitive to this substructure. And I think I agree with that, yes. Although the ultimate question is, if you give me a fixed source position, right, and if you add a substructure, then you can change the magnification wildly. But the real question is, do you change the distribution significantly? Because there could be other event that you have a high magnification, but then adding substructure, you destroy this high magnification. So things can go both ways. So the question is really like, after accounting for those, do you completely remove these events, or maybe you enhance the number of these events by a large factor? Yes, this I don't think that anybody has done some calculation like that.
Yeah, I think it would be interesting to look at that. Yeah.
I think the interesting prediction is that, at least when you neglected this very small substructure, right? You do expect a significant fraction of events living here. So they will be, it will be something like 2 LIGO alerts within half an hour, and they are very highly magnified.
Okay, thanks.
So in the interest of time, maybe let's stop here and thank Liang again so that we can unmute ourselves.